Hi, everybody, and welcome back to another fabulous episode of Nightmare Now, the show where we talk about wondrous whaling excursions and, well, everything else. I don't really have a script today. I'm kind of going a little bit more off the cuff. I've been trying to move away from a script and make it more conversational and still hit all the important plot points for each episode. So we'll see how this one goes, and I'm glad to have you here. This is a show where we talk about all things horrific, historical, cryptids, legends, all that bullshit. Let's get right down into it. So this is going to be a part two episode. This, I think, is our first part two episode. So it's a two-parter talking about the disaster on the whale ship Essex. Being our first two-parter, I'm not really sure how to start this off. So if you didn't hear part one, check out last week's episode. It's great. I've gotten great feedback. Everybody loves it. The best. So I guess I'll do a quick recap of last week's episode and what we're talking about today. We're talking about the disaster on the whale ship Essex, which was a whale ship that got attacked by a whale, and because of that, the 20-person crew got shipwrecked. I don't know if I mentioned this last episode, but one of the black crew members, I don't remember his name, I don't have it in front of me, but he deserted in somewhere in South America. So it was 20 crew members and not 21 as was reported in episode one. But basically, this was one of the most famous maritime disasters in history up until that point, and the story inspired the famous novel Moby Dick. What we've got is a whale ship that went down to South America and got attacked by a whale, and what we have ahead of us is the struggle to survive for all the people that survived the attack by the whale, which was all of them. Nobody died in the initial whale attack. So whaling was a lucrative business, and it basically paved the way for the Industrial Revolution. So whaling had an important place in not just Nantucket, Massachusetts, and United States history, but world history. So the Essex took off from Nantucket, Massachusetts, the whaling capital of the world, with mostly a new, very green crew in 1819. So right from the get-go, they faced hardship. Their ship almost flipped over in a storm. All this stuff is from last episode, so I'm just giving a quick recap here. If you want to know more, check that out. There was a dearth of whales. I don't know how to say that. Darth? And there was one unsuccessful hunt where one of the whale boats got destroyed. And it was followed by a couple of successful hunts. I went into a little detail last week about what happened to the whales after a successful hunt, how the flesh got boiled down, all that yucky, smelly good stuff. But when they got to South America, things really took a turn. They looped around Cape Horn. Yeah, I know. Cape Horn. They made it up to Argentina, I believe, and they met with another mysterious captain whose ship had sunk and was kind of stranded in Argentina. He told them about the offshore ground, which was sort of a legendary hunting grounds for whales, where there were hundreds of these sperm whales that were kind of becoming sparser and sparser in the Atlantic and in other areas of the Pacific. But out here, there was still plenty of them. And plenty of them there were. When the Essex eventually made it out to the offshore ground, they found a big fat whale, started hunting it, and that's when disaster struck. One of the whales, as if possessed by Satan himself, or in some weird, competitive, testosterone-fueled rage, slammed into the boat multiple times, knocking it over and getting it ready to sink. And that's pretty much where I left you guys off last week. So let's just jump right into where we are this week. So all the crew jumped into the whale boats that they were already in, or they could take off of the Essex, and kind of hung around the ship for about 2 or 3 days. They spent this time searching for supplies. They got sewing needles, thread, hardtack, which was a bread basically devoid of moisture. So this was bread that you could pretty much break your teeth on if you didn't wet it down first. And the benefit of that was that you could carry enormous amounts of it without having it go bad and without it taking up a whole lot of space, because without the water, it was fairly light, but still kept really well. So they got a ton of this hardtack, not a literal ton, but almost. And one of the last things I mentioned last episode was one of the crew members got a couple of the charts, a compass, and some of the navigation tools that they would need in the coming voyage. And that was all before the ship sank 3 days after it had been struck by the whale. By the second day, though, the Essex had already fallen to pieces. So while they were tied up to the main hull of the whaleboat, or the whale ship, rather, the mast, different parts of the wood, even shards of glass from the captain's cabin kept floating around and threatened to puncture holes in all the whaleboats. So over the period of time where they would be examining the wreck and kind of looting it for whatever they could find and whatever they could stuff onto the whaleboats without sinking them, they also had to have people on watch to make sure that, you know, a stray piece of the mast wouldn't spear open one of the whaleboats and sink it. And in a cruel irony, all around them, as the whale ship tipped over and kind of gave its death throes, a disgusting yellowish fluid billowed up to the top of the water. And that was, of course, the whale oil. The whale oil that they had spent their entire voyage chasing, bet their fortune on, and the whole reason that they were trapped out here in the first place was now spilling out over their boats, out of the whale ship that they had come from. And what had once been kind of their fortune, their meal ticket, had now become something dangerous. It was making everything slippery and flammable, and obviously they couldn't sell it at that point. They were more focused on, you know, getting home alive. So by the third day, they had drifted some 50 miles away from South America compared to where the ship had initially been hit by the whale. It was drifting. I mean, you still had some masts up, and you had currents, you had wind working against it. And so when they did the calculations on the third day, they're like, oh shit, we're 50 miles away from where we should be headed, so we gotta get away from this ASAP. And it was that day at noon that they called kind of like a captain's meeting for all of the people on board. Namely, George Pollard, the captain, Owen Chase, the first mate, and Matthew Joy, the second mate. And so they got all of them together on one boat, and they kind of argued for a while about where to go, given that their, you know, one chance of salvation was rapidly sinking towards the bottom of the ocean. So they had a couple of different options. The number one option that they had, and this was after doing some calculations to figure out exactly where they were and exactly where the closest land was to them, and there was a bunch of land in the Marchesas out to the southwest. This stuff was only like 1,000 miles away. And even then, that's a long fucking ride in a whaleboat. But it was the shortest of all the possible options. But the first mate and second mate, Owen Chase and Thomas Joy, decided amongst themselves that headed towards the west would lead them kind of towards Polynesia, Oceania, and those islands in Indonesia and what have you. And in what would end up being an even more cruel irony than the whale oil spilling out from the boat that they had just escaped from, they decided to not head that way, even though the wind and the currents would put them that way, so it would be a much easier ride. They assumed that those islands were populated by cannibals. And this, of course, was partially true. There was rumors swirling around of cannibals that would eat whoever came onto their shore. But at the same time, there was also well-established colonies. There was a mission colony in Tahiti. There was another island out in those Marchesas that was the final site of all the crew of the mutiny from the Bounty. So there was a well-laid precedent for ways to go that way. The second option was to head back the way they came towards the Galapagos Island, and that would be northeast. Yeah, northeast, and then straight east. But the thing is, the wind was blowing against them all the way, the current was blowing against them all the way, and they really could only travel with the wind because of the whaleboats, which we'll get to in a second. So that was pretty much an impossibility, to be sure. The third option was to head northwest to Hawaii, but again, you had the wind against you. It was pretty fucking far away, and you had tales of storms and the Night Marchers. If you want to hear more about the Night Marchers, check out episode 14. Wow, can you believe we're on episode 16 now? Crazy. So they didn't really want to go to the Hawaiian Islands, and I gotta agree with them, that would have been a bad idea anyway. But the fourth option they had was to head south for other smaller islands and eventually head west to the coast of South America. Keep in mind, they're about somewhere between 1,000 and 2,000 miles west of South America. I'm trying to make sure I get all my cardinal directions right in this episode. They eventually decided, after much deliberation, that going towards the potential cannibals was not the move, even though it probably would have been the best decision they could have possibly made. They decided to head towards the southeast, hit some of the islands down there, namely Henderson and Ducey Island. From there, head due east towards the mainland of South America. One benefit of this was that everything would be in their hands. You know, they might get rescued by a whale ship, or they might get lucky with an island or something. But by and large, this put their own fate into their own hands, which is something that really can't be understated. People want to be in charge of their own destiny. So doing their own work, getting towards South America, they would be in charge of getting themselves home rather than kind of floating around and hoping that a whale ship found them, which in this offshore ground and being blown around the way they were, the chances of that were slim to none. So Pollard wanted to head towards where they thought the cannibals were, which would have been the best option, but Thomas Joy and Owen Chase wanted to head towards South America. And it's interesting psychologically that Pollard kind of gave way to the crew, the first and second mate in this circumstance, much like he did right at the beginning of this voyage when Owen Chase, the first mate, suggested that they continue on instead of returning to Nantucket for repairs when the ship got hit by a storm and flopped over and, you know, lost a whaleboat and shredded some of the sails and stuff. Psychologists say that this shit is really not good in a disaster scenario until things get really dire in order to improve morale. So at the beginning of a survival scenario, and remember this if you take away nothing else from this episode, is that you want to be decisive. Somebody's got to make a decision and the whole group has to go along with it from the get-go. Later on, when you're trying to figure out who's going to get eaten, or, you know, what way do we go when we're faced with mountain lions or tigers or whatever, that's when you want to have that democratic conversation and a vote to get where you want to go, and that helps improve morale. But at the beginning, people don't know what to do, and they need to have some kind of task. The ill-fated crew of the Essex decided to head for option number four, which was head southeast towards whatever islands were there and eventually hit South America. So what did we have in these whale ships? So we had food for around 60 days, and that consisted of in each of these whale boats. And they were like, it was a little more advanced than a life raft, but not by much. They had about 200 pounds of hardtack each in each of the three whale boats, and they rationed that to 6 ounces a day, which was about a fourth of the caloric intake needs of a 5'8", 145-pound man, which is kind of the average of all the people on the Essex. People were a lot shorter back then, so that's that. Hardtack overall was a disgusting bread devoid of moisture. I think I already talked about this, where you could snap your teeth on it and break your teeth open if you didn't get it wet. But it was easy to store. It kept up well. It didn't go bad quickly. So it was an ideal piece of food technology for the open seas. Of course, they had tortoises that they collected from the ship as it was sinking. Because if you recall, Thomas Chappell lit the entire island of the Galapagos on fire, and they took whatever tortoises they could. So any tortoises that were on the Essex were literally the last ones of their species. So they're kind of all floating around, swimming around, and they were big fatties. They were like 85 pounds a pop, I think, given the shell and the muscle and how old they were and everything. So each of these whale boats had two tortoises to spare. And the rest of the tortoises kind of just doggy paddled around the Essex because they couldn't take them. It was a weight issue. There was all kinds of other problems. But saving the tortoises was not one of the primary concerns once you're 2,000 miles from shore and your ship is sinking fast. One thing that they had to forgo from the Essex was tobacco. Normally a whaler would go through 70 fucking pounds of tobacco on a trip. And that's obviously from setting out to from Nantucket all the way out to their return voyage 2 or 3 years later. But at the same time, saving the tobacco is really not a priority in a survival situation. So most of the crew this whole time is going through Nikki withdrawals. So that's another fun survival aspect to add on top of everything else. And of course, what else did they have for food but the same thing DMX feeds his dogs? People! But I think we'll probably get to that kind of thing next episode. So the crew overall was 9 Nantucketers, 5 Koofs, and if you recall, those Koofs were white sailors that weren't from Nantucket. So I think actually everybody on the Essex was actually from Cape Cod in Massachusetts. And then you had 6 blacks. So each boat had 200 pounds of the hardtack, 65 gallons of water, 2 tortoises, and the first mates, Chase and Joy, each got a pistol, and Pollard took a musket. So here we get into the kind of politics we talked about last week about who got preference in the whale boats, and those same principles apply in this crazy survival situation. So Captain Pollard got 5 Nantucketers out of his 7-man boat, 2 Koofs, and I don't think he got any African-American sailors. Of note for now, you got to remember he got Owen Coffin, Barzilai, Ray, I really don't know how to say his name, Barzilai, and Charles Ramsdell. These are basically the 3 teenagers. Thomas Nickerson, the cabin boy, was the youngest at 14, but these 3 were kicking around at 15 years old. They had grown up together on Nantucket, and Owen Coffin, notably, was George Pollard's first cousin, and he had sworn an oath to keep said cousin safe on this voyage, an oath that he would somewhat dramatically break later on in a very, very unfortunate bit of circumstance. Moving on, we had Chase's boat. Owen Chase, the first mate, he had 2 Nantucketers, 2 Cape Cod Koofs, and 2 black sailors. And in Joy's boat, which was another cruel irony being in the boat of Joy, there was no joy happening in any of these boats. But he had himself, 1 Koof, and 4 black sailors. So in these whale boats, obviously they're meant for doing quick, you know, rowing out to the whale, stabbing it, doing that whole thing. They are not meant for 2,000-mile voyages across the open water. So they had to retrofit these whale boats, which is basically like a 20-foot dinghy. That's pretty much what we're working with. It's like 3 bench seats, a rudder, maybe a spot for harpoons and stuff, but I don't think they brought much of the harpoons along with them. So they took the sewing needles that they had recovered from Chase's sea chest when the Essex was sinking, and they ripped up the sails and a couple of beams from the ship and made new sails for the whaleboats to, you know, be usable on the open sea. And then another key component that they did to make these whaleboats seaworthy was to kind of take some timber from the Essex and build up a perimeter around the boats. So kind of like the whole outside of the boat, they built up like another foot of wood alongside it to keep it sturdy. And if they hadn't have done this, 2 weeks down the line when they're all weak from hunger and the waves are coming over the boats, they all would have sunk. They all would have been swamped out. The crews in each boat would not have had the energy to keep bailing the water out with their buckets and what have you. And all three ships would have sank. I keep saying ships. All three boats would have sank to the bottom without any chance of survival. And the last kind of modification that they would make to the boat, it wasn't really a modification so much as a strategic planning, is that they took other bits of sail from the Essex and wrapped all the hardtack and other bread and meat and what have you and put it in these little cupboards that were towards the back of the boats. And these were ideally supposed to keep the bread and meat and whatever else they had on hand safe from the swells and waves of the ocean. But unfortunately, it really didn't work all that well. It's certainly better than, you know, just leaving out in the middle. And they probably would have died a lot sooner if they had done that. But at the same time, in a tiny little 20-foot dinghy or whatever, you really can't keep the waves out forever. Okay, I am back. If I sound a little bit different, it's because last time I was recording the other half of this episode, I literally fell asleep at my computer. So that's a good warning to really not stay up until the middle of the night. And because of a bunch of other circumstances, that's why this episode is coming out the next Thursday. Yeah, so after that brief interlude, which I will cut away through the magic of editing, we're going to continue on. So last we talked, which was for you about 30 seconds ago, but for me about a week ago, we were talking about how they took the whale boats and built up the sides to make them more resistant to the swells and, you know, tumultuous parts of the sea creeping into it. And after they had set up those makeshift sea walls, built up the new sails, they were pretty much ready to leave the Essex. It was only drifting further and further away from wherever they needed to go, and they had salvaged pretty much everything that they possibly could carry into the whaleboats. So everybody knew that they needed to leave. But you have to imagine the kind of terror of the unknown, and despite the fact that the ship is overturned and sinking slowly, it seems like suicide to leave it, even though it's clearly suicide to stay. So morale that evening was just at a all-time low. I mean, it'll reach new lows pretty soon, but for the time being, because over the last 3 days where they had been scavenging the ship for supplies, everybody has a task to build up the gunwales or, you know, make the sails or figure out how they're going to store the food, wrangle up the tortoises that they could. But when it finally came time to leave, you know, nobody really wants to leave the ship behind. It's more because of what it represents than any real chance at salvation. You know what I mean? It's kind of their last piece of home besides each other. Obviously, everyone wishes that none of that stuff happened with the ship, you know, sinking and all. But like my man Gandalf says, so do all who live to see such times. But that is not for them to decide. All we have to decide is what to do with the time that is given us. And the time that is given the crew of the Essex is not really a sea cruise vacation or anything like that. And off they went into the wild blue, the big pond. They headed southeast towards some islands off of the shore of South America because, again, sailing north would have been pretty much impossible given the current. So they were hoping to hit something there and make way for the shore when the currents allowed it. And what is the first major event that happens on their journey? You'll never guess, but they get attacked by a whale. I feel like at that point, I don't know. I feel like I would have just given up. So the three boats are kind of sticking together as best they can, sailing across the ocean. And then suddenly you see a big black, like, shark fin looking thing. And it's, of course, an orca, a killer whale. And he just kind of swims around Captain Pollard's boat a couple of times. The Jaws theme is playing, even though it won't exist for another 180 years or something. 170 years? Yeah, 170 years or so. And after it's done scaring them, just with its fin alone and the big mammalian body with rippling muscles beneath the waves, encircles the boat, it starts taking bites out of it. It starts going up to the wood and chomping down on the boat. So you have these guys that are already, like, completely panicked. They all think they're gonna die. Very low morale. And as if cursed by God himself, another whale shows up to take a bunch of bites out of their boat. And luckily, they managed to kind of poke it away with some oars. And maybe they had a harpoon on board. It's kind of unclear. But they were trying to stab it, and eventually it just left. So not a good omen of things to come there. Of course, that and the wild nature of the sea led to these whale boats that are just meant for short excursions, not usually more than a mile or two from the Essex itself, to have to make this huge overseas journey, and they're just not built for that. So you have killer whales biting, you have giant waves slamming into it, you have makeshift mast throwing off the physics of the whole thing. And obviously the ships are starting to fall apart. And it's because of the initial reinforcing of the gunwales that they did right at the beginning that I talked about a few minutes ago, that they were able to even survive just this basic bit of repairs that they had to do. And it was really interesting how they ended up doing it, because they did bring along some extra wood from the Essex in anticipation of having to make these repairs. And so what they would do is, while all three boats were together, say Pollard's boat had a bite taken out of it or whatever. I don't think it ever got that serious. Like, I don't think there was a huge hole in it. But, you lose parts of the wood, water starts to leak. And what they would do is they would all go on one side of the whaleboat and kind of flip it up. Like, not flip it over, but just, you know, when you lean on one side of a boat, the end tips up. And then one of the other whaleboats would go over and hammer a board onto the bottom of it while it was up above the water. So they had this really cool dynamic where everybody obviously has to help each other along, but all these whaleboats really depended on one another in more ways than just keeping the crew together, keeping morale as best they could, and being able to make decisions between the captain and first and second mates and everything. So it's kind of cool seeing that dynamic at work. But man, the irony of the whale hunters being hunted by whales is just crazy. This whole thing is just like an exercise in the cruelest irony in the world. Alanis Morissette doesn't know shit. Maybe I'll do a cover. Maybe I'll do a Isn't It Ironic cover. It's like, it's like wailing when you're the prey and your friend died, but you already ate. Something like that. Maybe somebody more musically talented can take that on. Somebody wants to help promote the show. That would be fun. So aside from getting attacked by whales, almost drowning, and horrible musical covers, you had all kinds of other dangers. Even the salt in the water itself was a huge danger. All that extra salt, it was getting into the water, it was getting into the bread. So whenever they would eat or drink, obviously drinking salt water makes you more thirsty, dries you up inside, and additionally it makes your kidneys have to work overtime, and when they're already not getting the nutrition they need, having organs in your body trying to work overtime to process it doesn't help. So the first week goes by pretty much uneventfully besides, you know, the whale attack. But even that wasn't anything super severe. It was just, you know, horrifying from a psychological standpoint. On day 8, they were like, fuck this. We are so sick of this hard bread. We need to eat something. And so each of the whale boats butchered one of their Galapagos tortoises. Keep in mind, again, that these are the last 6 remaining members of that species. This is a extinction level event. And they're just, you know, spare dinner. Each of these tortoises had an estimated 4,500 calories. So that's like a Thanksgiving dinner here in America is like 4,500 calories. So you can imagine that they're going off of like 500 calories a day to that. And they just go absolutely apeshit. It is a bloodbath. They cut them up and they cook the tortoise in the shell, I think, and eat it all. They don't save any bit of it. And then they're like patting their distended bellies and being like, oh, we're so hungry, boss. They didn't save any of it. So it was back to the hardtack the next day. Maybe they went a day without because of the renewed vigor that the tortoise meat gave them. Yeah, now there's 3 of those tortoises left in the world. That's a fun little side plot we've got going in here, the extinction event. So another 4 days pass, and there's a couple of storms. The boats kind of drift apart a little bit. They're still together, but like everybody's strength is starting to wane. It's tough to kind of maintain the rudder, make sure everybody, all 3 of these boats are sticking together within eyesight of each other, especially during the night. I believe for a while they were tying the boats to each other, and I'm not really sure why they stopped that or if they weren't doing that at all. I'll have to look that up and I'll get back to you. On the night of the 12th day since the actual sinking of the Essex, since they left the Essex, one of the boats, I think it was Thomas Joy's boat, got separated from the rest of them. And they're like, oh, shit, that's a third of the crew just gone. And it's getting dark. They have lanterns to kind of spot each other in the distance. And you got to imagine Thomas Joy's boat is just like panicking and hooting and hollering. And so one of them fires off a pistol just into the air and they actually manage to find themselves. So, or not find themselves, but find each other. Although I guess everybody went on a little journey of self-discovery on this voyage. Find out what they're really made out of. Another couple of days pass and they manage to stay together, and then they find the biggest storm that they've had since day 2 of leaving Nantucket, that they could have turned back and fixed it, maybe avoided this whole mess, but fate works in mysterious ways. Despite this storm and this gale, everyone managed to stay together, and they literally had lightning striking down all around them. Somehow none of the boats got hit, which is pretty crazy to me, given that, you know, you're at sea level and the only thing around you, you would be the tallest thing, right? Because of the mast. But I guess the waves would go up higher and maybe that's how that works. I'm not sure. I didn't really do a whole lot of lightning research on this one. So that'll be something, maybe I'll figure that one out for you and post it to the Twitter or Instagram or something. Some fun electricity trivia. So luckily, after the storm, all 3 of the boats were kind of pretty close together. And this was the morning after, so like the sun came up and everybody breathed a collective sigh of relief because they could see each other. And every day that the boats were still together was a day that all the people kind of had each other to confide in and do the High School Musical, we're all in this together sort of thing. So a few days later was December 9th, and this was day 19 away from the wreck of the Essex. And given their compass and sextant and navigational charts, they figured that they could hit Tahiti in a week. And again, people are like, nah, we do not really want to run into cannibals right now. We're too weak to fight them off. It really is just horrible. I mean, you can kind of see where I'm going with this ironic thing, right? The law of the sea. So they decided that they could hit Tahiti in a week, but still, they'd rather take their chances on the open ocean on the trip to South America than get eaten by savage natives. Again, bad idea. They lost contact with Pollard that day, but regained it the next day with a gunshot. And same thing, they shot a gun into the air, and they did their best as their weakened bodies could to row towards the gunshot and regroup. So that was another panic point for everybody as the boats were kind of more and more frequently getting lost from each other. It became harder for everybody to stay awake and maintain watches and row the boats when the sails weren't working. They had very little strength to go on given their diet. And it's at this point that Owen Chase, in the first mate in his boat, kind of writes about, I mean, he doesn't write this now, but later on he writes, which is what his account and Thomas Nickerson's account is kind of what the In the Heart of the Sea is based up off of with a bunch of other sources. But he talks about the rationing of the hardtack at this point. And he slept with his hand on the chest that they kept all the food in, and the gun in his hand. And if anybody tried to take from the bread chest, he would just be like, all right, if you guys can't handle this civilly, we're going to divide it up evenly, and you will be in charge of rationing your own food, which I think is a kind of interesting democratic way to go about it, where, you know, everybody is kind of put in control of their own destiny rather than doing the sensible thing and having one person in charge of rationing it. But at the same time, he's like, make no mistake, if it comes to that, or if somebody touches my bread, they're getting a bullet to the brain. No questions asked. So cut to December 14th. So this is day 24 away from the Essex wreck. It was obvious that they were not anywhere close to making their timeline that they would need to, given that they had about 60 days worth of food. And all the calculations and everything pointed to the fact that they would run out of food long before they made it to South America if they continued on their current rate. And remember, they're already only having about a quarter of the caloric needs of somebody in an average situation, let alone a survival situation where they have to bail out water, stay under the beating sun, drink and eat food inundated with salt, and they cut rations in half. So that was 3 ounces per day of the hardtack for each member. So that's like an eighth of your total like daily energy expenditure. So things were starting to get dire. I mean, from the get-go, they were dire, but there's a kind of never-ending escalation in all this entire scenario. It was at this point, I think, maybe earlier, that they started to drink their piss. Do Bear Grylls proud. In a survival situation, the number one thing you have to do is drink your own piss. I guess it helps. It helps you retain moisture. It's sterile. One of the grossest things I saw him do is, and I know some of that is set up for him, but whatever, I still love the show, where he takes this big glob of elephant shit and just like squeezes it like it's an orange into his mouth. He's like, now that is a lot of moisture. That's the kind of thing that'll keep you going for an extra 2 days out here in the desert. I don't know if they were juicing their shit on the boat. The book doesn't really mention that. I think for the most part, they were just taking dumps off the side of the boat. And they started suffering from hypothermia. Obviously, they're getting splashed with this water. It's brutally cold at night and brutally hot during the day. So you have temperature fluctuations. There's probably always a little bit of water in the bottom of the boat. And like I said before, seawater after a certain point, like I sure people have spent a day at the beach or whatever and spent most of the time in the water and your skin gets a little wrinkly. Make that like a day and a half or like a couple of weeks of nonstop exposure to seawater and it starts to become like acid. Dries out your skin, rips it open, keeps everything wet, keeps your cellular processes from working properly, and it if you're in the water for too long, it is just, it can be devastating. And it's here that Philbrick in The Heart of the Sea lays out horrifying consequences of extreme thirst. So it starts out, and this is how the Essex survivors were starting to deal with it when they began drinking their own piss. Your saliva starts to get thick and taste awful, and your tongue just starts sticking to the roof of your mouth and your teeth, and it makes it really hard to talk. And the whole time, all you want to do is talk. You want to just say, I'm so thirsty. I just, again and again and again, just keep talking about how thirsty you are. You're trying to swallow the whole time, trying to get any drip of this disgusting saliva that you're producing to go into your belly and nourish your body, but it doesn't do anything. You get this big dry lump in your throat. And because you're losing all this moisture all over your body, your skin starts to almost vacuum seal to your skull. It is horrifying. All your skin cells are losing all their water as well, so everything's shrinking. Everything's getting tight over every bone and whatever muscle they had left at this point, which was still a considerable amount. Oftentimes people would hallucinate or hear things or lose their hearing. All kinds of stuff. All kinds of really, really bad stuff happens to you when you start to not have water in your body. People can go weeks without food, but a few days without water and you're done. And Philbrick actually brings up this awesome study. I mean, it's not awesome, it's horrific. But this study on this guy that was a prospector out in New Mexico or something that got separated from his group. Whatever, the details aren't important, but basically the guy survived for more than 7 days without water. Of course, he was drinking his own piss. And so he had that, and he had, like, he squeezed a scorpion, and that was the only moisture he had for 7 days. But he survived, and he actually managed to describe his experience. So what was soon to come for the crew of the Essex, not just yet, because they had just begun to die of thirst. The tongue would start to swell up. It would be all hard on the end because, you know, the extremities is where the water drains from, and that applies to the tongue as well. So the base would be still soft, like the back of your tongue would still be soft, but the front would just be like a piece of hardtack, like a rock that would just like bump up against your teeth and your mouth. And I know people talk about mouthfeel with like beer or like other foods and stuff. Can you imagine the mouthfeel if like your tongue turned to stone? You wouldn't be able to talk. You'd just be constantly aware of the feeling. Ugh. And then after that, it gets even worse. The next phase is happily called blood sweats. So your eyelids start to crack and your eyes would start weeping tears of blood. Your eyes would weep tears of blood. Blood would come out of your skin where anywhere where the blood vessels weren't like real deep into the skin. And then the whole time your throat, all the moisture in your throat is starting to go. So you have just this like stony feeling on the inside of your body and you start to be unable to breathe. And I guess the feeling is the same as drowning. So it's just another one of those horrible fucking ironies where it's like there is no water in your entire body, but it feels like you're dying of drowning. And it is just awful. And then the next phase, whatever scientist did this study and interviewed this guy had really a sense for the macabre. Because the next phase was what's called a living death. And I'll actually just like read that aloud here because this passage really struck me. His lips had disappeared as if amputated, leaving low edges of blackened tissue. His teeth and gums projected like those of a skinned animal, but the flesh was black and dry as a hank of jerky. His nose was withered and shrunken to half his length, and the nostril lining showed black. His eyes were set in a winkless stare, with surrounding skin so contracted as to expose the conjunctiva itself, black as the gums. His skin had generally turned a ghastly purplish, yet ashen gray, with great livid blotches and streaks. His lower legs and feet, with forearms and hands, were torn and scratched by contact with thorns and sharp rocks. yet even the freshest cuts were so many scratches in dry leather, without the trace of blood. Now, at this point, the people on the Essex still had half a pint of water a day, and that is really not a whole lot of water, so they weren't getting to that point yet, but they'll pretty much get there. But God, isn't that a ghoulish description? So at one point on that day, the people in Owen Chase's boat were so overwhelmed with the dryness and the heat juxtaposed with the splashing of the uncomfortable salt water that they decided to try to cool off and just dunk their bodies over the side of the boat and into the water. And one of them came out of the water and just screamed. And he screamed with joy because he looked into the water and under the boat they had grown a bunch of barnacles and mussels or something. And they had food again. They had a little bit of extra food. And this was, to them, this is like 25 days on, 24 of 25 days on. This is a feast for kings. Remember, this is like more than 2 weeks since they ate the tortoise. But the problem is they were too weak to even pull themselves back up out of the water. So they had to have everybody on the boat pull one person up one at a time. And they would grab as many of these things as they could. And eventually they got all of the barnacles or whatever off the bottom of the boat and had, you know, a couple of them. Everybody had their fill and they were like, we are going to save these barnacles. They are going to save our lives. We're going to keep them all right here in the middle of the boat and just look at them. And you can just imagine every single one of them is just like lip licking their just like dried out lips, looking at these flopping around barnacles on the middle of the boat. And within a half hour, they ate all of them. And the other boats quickly followed suit with their own barnacles and none were saved. Probably not a smart idea. But I can't really judge them, right? I wasn't out on a boat for a month with nothing to eat but hard bread and barnacles. With bellyfuls of barnacles, they went to sleep and kept going the same manner as they had been going for another 2 days. And that's when the first good thing, I mean, besides the barnacles, that's when the second good thing happened to them this whole time. It was December 19th. Day 29 from leaving the Essex, and one of the crew members, a man by the name of Will Wright, just kind of sat up from laying and crying or whatever they were doing at this point, and just yelled, "Land ho!" And he saw it. He saw an island, and it like a snap of their fingers, everybody got to attention. They're like, this is it. We are finally saved. We can get some food. We can get some water. And all three of the whaleboats head for shore. They shot their pistols into the air a couple of times, you know, just to make sure there aren't any cannibals on the island. You know, you can't be too careful with cannibals. And nothing came. So they went out onto the boat. This was their first landing on solid ground in like almost a month, if you count the Essex as solid ground, but probably 2 or 3 months before that. So everyone is overjoyed. Chase managed to spear a fish in the shallow water around there and just ate it immediately. Scales, bones, all of it. Everybody was trying to grab fish. There were some eggs from some tropical seabirds that made a residence on this island. And the seabirds just did not give a shit. There are no natural predators on this island, so they would just chill. They really would stay here their whole lives, fly out, catch some fish, fly into the middle of the island, do whatever they had to do. But they would just sit there, and these gangly, stretched skin, deep-set-eyed humanoids would run up and just pounce on these birds and just eat them alive, basically. I think eventually they would start to cook them once they got the initial hunger pains out of the way and realized that sushi has to be done right, and you can't just take bites out of the fish like you're Gollum. I mean, you can, but it's not the best way to do it. And most of all, they found a little trickle of spring water in the middle of this island. This was pretty much their salvation. They could fill up all their drinking casks. They could fill up on eggs and fish and get whatever they needed and stay on the island maybe a ship would pass by. So they decided to stay for a few days. And this is another thing where they had to kind of decide amongst the captain and the first mate what the plan was, what's the move. Because if this wasn't going to be the place that they stayed on, every second that they stayed on shore and weren't eating was like another second closer to death. If they ran out of food too early, or if they ran out of water or something, and they were just on the island, there was a good chance that they weren't going to make it to South America at all. So everyone, while overjoyed to be on solid land and eating eggs and doing all this happy stuff, still has this hanging over them that it's like, it's the same feeling they had leaving the Essex, where this is an area of relative safety away from the horrors that we faced for the last month. But at the same time, if we don't leave and go back and face those things, we're going to die. We're probably going to die if we do, but at least we have a chance. So while they're eating all these birds and eggs and crabs, they're looking around the island and they find a little cave. And they're like, there might be some more water in here. And then to their abject horror, they go into this cave, right? And what do they find? They find 8 skeletons, some of them children, just lying there in like New Englander clothes. These aren't like bodies of cannibals or savage natives or anything. These are other shipwreck survivors that had apparently died of thirst. And man, does that really put a damper on your party island, doesn't it? The water that did spring from the island, the trickle of spring water that they found, was only available for about 1 or 2 hours a day. Maybe it was 3 or 4 hours, whatever. 3 or 4 hours a day, because it was like below the tide line. So when the tide would get high, it would go over the spring water thing, and there was no way to get any other fresh water. There was like tide pools and rainwater pools or something or other. But they could basically only go around the circumference of this island, because the interior was like this big upheaved coral reef thing. And so none of them really had the strength to climb up it. So picture a sandy beach ring with like this big pillar of sharp limestone and coral in the middle, and then some kind of unknown plateau at the top. And that's what they were dealing with. There wasn't like a whole lot of plants or anything on this island. And that was December 19th they landed, and they stayed for a few days. And it was Christmas Eve that the birds began to leave. Obviously, they're dumb birds, because they just let the people just scoop them up off the ground and eat them. But they wised up to that pretty quick. After you see your third bird buddy get scooped up by a lunatic who does like an Ozzy Osbourne and bites you its head off, you kind of get the feeling that, like, you know, I have wings. Maybe I should fly away from these weirdos. So the birds were flying over, presumably to some other island to lay more eggs or whatever birds do. And then they had their Christmas feast and pretty much the last of the crabs and fish and whatever they could scavenge. And December 26th, this is a week after they've been on the island, and 36 days since they left the Essex. It was time to go. The food was running out. There was no way all of them would be able to survive on this island. The island they were on was a place called Henderson Island, and that was right next to Ducie Island, which is where, according to all their navigational materials, like the Atlas or whatever they had, that's where they thought they were. They thought they were on Ducie Island. And what's funny is that the islands are basically right next to each other, so it doesn't really matter until much later. But what is horrible is both of these islands were only 400 miles away from Pitcairn Island, which is where the crew from the Bounty ended up after the mutiny, and had successfully established like a little colony where, you know, they could be picked up and people lived out there. They would have fed them. They would have given them all the water they needed to survive. Or they could have just lived out there in that colony. And that was just 400 miles the other way. Unfortunately, at this point, they were about 3,000 miles from Chile. And they got to stick to the original plan, right? So on December 26th, the food was extinguished, and they decided it was time to head out. The island had done all it could for them. It obviously was not a safe place to stay long term, because on account of the skeletons, not like the skeletons attacking them or anything, but the skeletons are a pretty good indicator that it's not a good place to survive on. And it's then when Thomas Chapel, Seth Weeks, and Will Wright, who were all, I think they were all members of Thomas Joy's boat, so the second mates, and they were all, although maybe not, maybe it was different, but they were all the Koofs. They were all the Cape Cod people, so they weren't real Nantucketers. So they were going to take their chances all by on their own, and they decided to not go into the whale boats, and we would just stay on the island and take our chances there. At least we don't have to face the ocean. We may die here, and we might end up another three skeletons in that cave, but there is nothing that you're going to do to get me back into that boat to head towards shore. So they had a teary-eyed goodbye. Pollard promised to rescue them if he survived. He would send a ship over to Ducey Island, where he thought they were. And there's just this moment where everyone says goodbye to them, and they get back in the boats, and the three people that decided to stay on the island are just crying. They're just staring, dead-eyed, skin stretched, and crying, and when the boats take off, they don't even watch. They just walk back inland and sit down next to a fire and kind of contemplate the fact that they'll probably never survive and they'll never see any of those people ever again. But they figured they had a better shot there, and by some measure they probably did. At this point, the rest of the whale boats, they really can't object to those people staying behind, because, you know, one less mouth to feed. Maybe we get a little bit more of the hardtack every day. But it's hard seeing the crew that you survived with just left behind. As they shipped off from the island that might have been their only salvation, they looked to the horizon and where South America should be, and hit the open water once more. And that's pretty much where we're going to pick up next week. We're going to conclude the story, find out what happens to the three boats, maybe even find out what happens to the three Koofs that stayed on Henderson Island. But I am, as always, I'm so glad to have you here with us for this crazy story. Yeah, I don't have many listeners, but the ones I do have are the best in the world. So I'm happy to have you. I guess just take a minute and be glad that you're not stranded 3,000 miles from shore in a whale boat in the 1800s, and you're comfortably listening to a podcast in your car or at work or from your Alexa or whatever. Hopefully you have a bed for tonight. I'd say sweet dreams, but we all know there's only going to be nightmares now.